and Arnie Arneson, one of our favorite people. We are in a celebratory mood today. We've got Arnie with us on the phone, and you know her political chowder. You know this fabulous woman, you know, who has been so involved at just about every level, in my opinion, of government in one way or another. So, Arnie Arneson, tell me, what are you feeling from New Hampshire on these cold days?
The gag rule has been lifted. The gag rule has been lifted. Can I say that again? The gag rule has been lifted.
Exactly.
Let me share a quick story. As I read this, and I was just so happy. We thought he might have done it on the day of the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. He did it 24 hours later. But on my 21st birthday, do you know where I was? I was in an abortion clinic in the Twin Cities with my best friend. And I was holding her hand as she was about to get an abortion. And it was maybe 2 or 3 years after the passage of Roe v. Wade and it became legal and safe for women to have it. And I was writing my grandmother a note as I was sitting in the waiting room waiting for my friend to be done. And I wrote my grandmother about what it was like to turn 21 and to realize that it was an opportunity for us to recognize that we could make choices and respect our bodies. And the reason I was writing my grandmother is that my grandmother had a back alley abortion. And I wanted her to know that it was going to be different for me than it was for her. And as I read that the gag rule had been lifted, I realized about the choices that women all over the world were going to be able to make about what was good for their families, what was safe for their children, what made sense for their lives. And in the end, it's an important thing because it's not about abortion, it's about respect.
Well, Arnie Arneson, you know, I think the thing that I most enjoy about you is that I never quite know what you're going to be thinking about. And yes, indeed, you know, the ping pong ball, and I'm so glad the ball is in our court again. You know, the global gag rule has been lifted because it's been this ping pong ball ever since Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
And so indeed, but tell me, Arnie, you know, and I know this is ping pong back and forth, and we're watching Lilly Ledbetter. You know,
Oh my God, that's another exciting thing. And the rule of law is back, and they're closing Gitmo and transparency is amazing. I feel like I'm in like La La Land. But for 8 years we were living in the shadow, you know? Mm. And it's almost like the clouds are opening up, and what democracy is supposed to be about and what this shining beacon on a hill was that we thought was our country, I feel like it really is slowly being restored, including his first phone call to an international leader was to Abbas. Oh, my God. There's a great quote from Abbas's aide, like, are you sure? He really was on the phone. I mean, it's almost like even this.
Well, you know, yeah, I think that we didn't really realize, you know, I mean, I think we have, you know, the last 8 years, but just how hard and how step by step by step, you know, we kind of watched it chip away. And you know, the Articles of Confederation were back in a way. Yeah. We thought, what's happened? And I think that's what we're all finding, you know, just piece by piece, some of these heavy loads are getting lifted. And none of us are so Pollyannish that we think everything's solved and, you know, we've got the Savior into place. And so not at all of it. But to me, Arnie, the biggest thing is that I feel the American people are re-energized in the sense that they matter. Their voices will matter. And you know, it's not that we expect him to listen or, you know, follow necessarily all the things we want, but you really honestly feel, don't you feel, Arnie, that we'll be listened to at least?
Well, you know, let me share something with you because I had an interesting conversation on Thursday. I got back from France, and I have to tell you about France because it's just an amazing story, but I get back from France, and I'm booking my TV show for Friday, and I call a very, very well-known, well-spoken Republican in my state, really one of the young up-and-comers, and he ran Mitt Romney's campaign. He's well-respected, and I call him up, and Jim says to me, he said, you know, I can't make your show tomorrow, but let me just tell you something. We actually kind of think alike. And I said, really, Jim, what are you talking about? And he said, I was contacted by like the equivalent of CNN for New England. It's called New England Cable News. And we were both being asked to comment on Jean Shaheen replacing Senator Sununu as the new freshman senator from New Hampshire. And we gave the same answer, Arnie. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, you said to the reporter that you hope that Jeannie understands that there was one thing you really respected in Senator Sununu, was that on occasion he could walk away from his president and he could walk away from, you know, if the Senate had been controlled by the Republicans, by the majority leader, and exercise independent judgment and also understand that the Senate was an independent and discrete branch of government. It was separate from the executive branch. And that that ability to exercise that judgment was important, and that you hoped that Jeannie would be able to do the same. He said, you said exactly what I said. And I want everyone to know that I admire Barack Obama. I believe he has sound judgment. I believe he is smart. I also know that he's not the Messiah, and I know that he will not always do the right thing. And therefore, I pray that the legislature, the Congress, understands that they are a separate and distinct branch and that it is totally appropriate for them on occasion to say no. That means that they say no because it reflects their own judgment, it reflects the best interest of the people, and frankly, on occasion, it may be exactly what Barack Obama wants, is for them to say yes or no. Because sometimes he has to do certain things because of the politics of it, not because of the policy of it. And therefore, it is up to Congress to exercise their own judgment.
Well, Arnie, I want to pursue that in just a few minutes, particularly talking about fiscal policy, because I read some of those ones that you were so keen on, and wow. But first, I want to go back because, you were actually in France, during the inauguration. Number one, unless it was personal, what were you doing there? And you got to tell us what it was like watching the inauguration.
It was personal in the sense that I am now the guardian for my 88-year-old aunt. So I want all of us to raise our hand who are in the sandwich generation, taking care of our children and taking care of our parents. And I now have two situations where my 88-year-old aunt who lives in France, I am now her guardian, which means I have to dispose of her assets and bring her home. And I am now becoming almost the quasi-guardian for my parents. So I've got it in, stereo. So I was heading to France because I had to deal with the court and with the notaires just as Barack Obama is going to be giving his inaugural address, and I am so upset that I have to be in France and not at home. What a fool. Because let me tell you what was so almost miraculous about my trip. I'm flying from Newark to Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, and then I have to fly to Nice because I'm going to Cannes, which is where my aunt lives. And I'm in the Charles de Gaulle Airport, and I'm waiting online, and the bus is late, and the planes are late, and there are two men standing in front of me. They kind of look like old hippies, One's got pink glasses, one has wearing a biker jacket with long gray hair, and I'm looking at these two men going, do you boys ever grow up? I'm looking at them. And it turns out we end up having this amazing conversation, and who are they? But they are big moguls in the music industry business, and they are also going to be flying to Nice, like me, only on a different flight, because it turns out there is this international thing called the Medim of all the people in the music industry that are glomming onto Cannes to meet and talk about music and music production and the challenge in this economy for the music industry. We end up falling in love, these two men and myself, and we start talking about our lives and about Barack Obama. And they look at me and they say, you've got to be with us at the convention when Barack gives his speech. You have to be with us. I said, oh, here's my cell phone, call me. Well, it turns out that the only way they could get me in was they had to spin that I was a reporter for CNN. I'm like, CNN, could you make it like a smaller news organization? So they get me in as quote-unquote the media, and I end up on the Riviera, in this huge convention center, with people in the music industry, and you need to know that I am musically challenged. I mean, I could have been standing next to Paul McCartney, and I wouldn't have recognized him. And I am standing there watching Barack Obama with 1,000 of my closest friends in the music business, and it was just thrilling, because here they were, obviously, you could hear a pin drop in the room, of course, except when Rick Warren got up to speak, and then everybody booed, but this is the music industry, after all. And I am standing there watching Barack and listening to this, looking at these people, cheering and screaming, and there are tears pouring down my cheeks as Barack Obama is quoting George Washington and talking about that, 60 years ago, maybe his father couldn't have been served in this city, and watching this event, and this guy sitting next to me seeing the CNN media on my little card goes, boy, you're really different for someone in the media. I didn't know that they cried when they were supposed to be reporting. And I'm sitting there going, oh, yeah, I forgot. It was spectacular. It was spectacular on 1,000 levels because I got to watch their response and I got to watch their sense of hope. And then I got to sort of experience in a different place, and I thought, isn't it just like Barack Obama? He reaches out and brings diverse people together, and in some ways, he actually reached out and brought me into a setting that under any circumstances I would never have been in. I would never have attended a music event, and yet there I was standing there with some of the biggest and brightest and most talented people in a room, and what brought us together was him.
You know, Arnie, I'm curious because, you know, France was a special target, you know, for the last 8 years, the Freedom Fries, et cetera. And tell me, were you able to talk enough to the French? Did they see that, excuse me, as kind of an aberration of American policy? Or did they look upon it and think, what is happening in America?
I think there is just this universal sense of relief. And it's not the French, it is the world. The French were talking about it. I mean, I was watching BBC World before the inauguration. I mean, you have to understand, BBC World started at the crack of dawn on the day of the inauguration, and it was all inauguration all day long until midnight with the last ball closing down. I mean, this is BBC World. The French, the world, the Middle East, everybody was desperate for change, because the problem with the United States is we are too important. We are too powerful. Our mistakes become their mistakes. Our change becomes their change. And they were desperate for an excuse to change. And we have now provided it, not just for ourselves, not just for our economy, not just for our environment, but for the world. So there was a celebration in all the bars in France. Every bar was turned on to the Barack Obama inaugural address. Everybody, and there were 8,000 people in attendance at this event in Cannes, and 8,000 people were either watching it on the big screen or holding, you know, some sort of digital equipment up to their ears to catch every word, because it was just too important. And my daughter just called me. My daughter is working in Japan, and we were on Skype yesterday morning. And she says, look, 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 Mom. And she holds up the big front page of the Japanese newspaper. And there is the picture of Barack Obama getting sworn in. And there on one side is his speech in English, and on the other side, a translation in Japanese. She's like, she said, Mom, Barack Obama T-shirts are selling all over Japan. Barack Obama books are selling all over Japan. She's holding his Audacity of Hope up in Japanese. She said, you don't get it. She said, I am watching the Japanese as excited as you are.
You know, Arnie, I think that you really just hit it in the first line you said in this whole, you know, little segment, you know, that it was such a relief because, you know, in a way, I think the people not only of this country, but the people of the world truly have kind of, this is to me almost like an archetype that's being built. I think all of us were aware that we had reached the end of an era, and really those in power and who abuse power, you know, whether it's militarily, economically, however they've abused power, were trying desperately to stop this new wave. And I think all of us really were a little terrified that it might end, because we knew it was going to come to an end, but I think we were afraid it was going to be cataclysmically and so devastatingly. And somehow with Barack Obama, and not that he's a savior, I totally agree with
you. He's not the Messiah. That's what Gene Robinson said. Did you read Gene Robinson's prayer, the openly gay bishop from New Hampshire?
Yes, I did.
He reminded everyone that morning, he's a wonderful man. Let God hold him in the palm of his hand. But remember, he is human. He is not the Messiah.
But I feel that it was this whole sense of relief that you think, wow, you know, that we've got a new dawn. Well, we've had a new dawn really for a long time. And I think those in power have really tried to stop us seeing the light. And it is this whole kind of sense throughout the world that finally, you know, we can kind of be in a way that we can relax and we don't have to worry.
But it's also the strength of America. I hate to say it, but thank God for George Bush. Because you know what George Bush showed? George Bush showed that we know how to correct. George Bush showed that we can transition from such an extreme to such a change, and we can do it without bloodshed, and we can do it with civility, and George Bush can sit in the audience. I mean, think about this. Think about the fact that we are role modeling the ability to disagree, the ability to turn the ship of state without killing anyone. You know, I mean, the problem with the world, for so many places in the world, whether it's Africa or the Middle East, is that they are incapable of changing without a coup. And this is a dramatic change. It is more dramatic than some coups. You know, frankly, a coup is one dictator to the next dictator. This is really a change in policy. I mean, when Barack Obama said to Senator Kyle of Arizona the other day, I won, you didn't. And what was so powerful about that statement was, one, he was probably testy and tired. I understand that. But it was also a very important statement because Kyle was bitching and moaning about the fact that Barack Obama wanted to help people at the bottom end of the spectrum. He wanted to say to people who were low income, who perhaps didn't pay taxes, that we will help you by reminding Kyle, but you know what? They're working. And Ronald Reagan wanted the earned income tax credit. It was his idea that you value work. These people are working at garbage salaries, but they're working, sweetheart. You know, and let's face it. And I just think that when he turned to Kyle and said, I won, it wasn't just that he won. It was the concept of who he is that won.
Well, I tell you, Ernie, listen, do you have any other aunts or something? You know, I could help you in this. If you,
yeah.
You know, as women, we have to help and support each other.
Well, you know, and the other interesting piece is again, in some ways, I am the poorest person in the world when it comes to money, but the richest person in the world when it comes to experience. As I'm over in France to dispose of my aunt's things, to eventually bring her home, there's a couple across the hall, and they're from Iran. And they take me in. They worried about me as I was packing her things. I was all alone and I was exhausted. And they would bring me tea and they would bring me bowls of fruit. And we started talking. And again, here's the power of change and the power of a new world. This Iranian couple told me, and they said, where do you live, Arnie? And I said, I live in Hopkinton, New Hampshire. And they said, oh, that's just north of Concord, New Hampshire. And I looked at them and I said, yeah, how did you know? And it turns out that their older son was in Concord, New Hampshire, the week before the Shah was overturned, back in the 70s, because he was looking at a school called St. Paul's School. And it turns out that while he was looking at the school in Concord, the Shah was overturned, and instead of sending him to school that fall, they sent him to school in Concord, New Hampshire that week, because he could not go back to Iran. And so we were talking about the Middle East, and we were talking about what's changing and about the leadership in Iran. And then she started telling me about her family, and she said her daughter had just gotten married in New York. I said, oh, really? She said, yes, Arnie, my Iranian Muslim daughter married a Jew. And I'm sitting there, and I started to cry. And she said, look at this picture. And it was a picture of the chuppah and a picture of something called, I think it's called the safir, which is the table that is set with all the sweets that you do in the Middle Eastern tradition. And both of them were at the front of the hall. And I said, so how did you handle that? She said, he's a good man. And I said, I am so happy. So again, to me, it was almost like it was so special to be where I was, to meet an Iranian couple whose daughter had married a Jew, because that's where the future is.
Well, you know, Arnie, we find this. You know, there's a universality that's really happening palpably before our eyes. You know, we know globalization and NAFTA and all the problems it has brought, but we see this tightening of all of our connections, you know, the spider web actually of people. And to me, you know, I think that's why I always so enjoy talking to you, because, you know, you just have all these events happen. But I think it's because you are such a vital person, and you really embrace life. And I think when one really embraces life, I think these things all open. And to me, that's what's been missing, particularly these last 8 years, that the fear has denied too many people the capacity to really embrace life.
Well, if Barack, I mean, you saw Hillary Clinton go into the State Department, and you think that it was like the arrival of the queen. They were jumping up and down, and they were like popping champagne. They were so excited. I have never seen people at the stage. It was like, you know, she walked in like the liberator. I swear to God, I felt like she had just opened the camp. You know, it's like unbelievable to me. I think what is so important now is that we have to be open. We have to be open to change. We have to be open to making mistakes. There's a great article, I'll have to send it to you, just before I left for Europe. The reporter for the National Telegraph called me up and said, so tell me about Barack Obama, and what do you expect, and what do you hope for? I said, what I hope he does for the American people is explain to them that there's no roadmap to fixing this. There is no roadmap to understanding how we can solve the Middle East. But what we know we can't do is do nothing. And what I hope he asks the American people is to give him a chance to be creative, to try different and new things, and to ensure them that when things don't work, that he has the authority to change, but he has to try. Because we are going to screw up, but we will screw up even more if we don't start experimenting. And this is an opportunity, because I think we all are sobered up enough to recognize the gravity of the situation, that we have to give him the license to do a little bit in the way of experimentation, because the problems are so diverse and so complex and so enormous that we have to begin to figure out what works and what doesn't. And that's the most important thing. I really do think so. And I think that the American people are almost on the verge of recognizing that it's okay, we'll take the plunge with you.
I totally agree. And so, Ernie Arneson, I go to your website commonly, Political Charter. If nothing else, I like to see what you're recommending, you know, to read, because you are really zeroed in. And, you know, I have to bring you back, because I was noticing some of the guests you had before, and economics is obviously really on your mind. And so I really want to get your take on some of the, you know, some of the economics that's really happening here. But it, always a delight. And so I thought I've got to see what Ernie did in France.
That's right. Hanging out with a bunch of music types. Oh, well, watching the inauguration. Oh, my God. Who would have thunk it?
Oh, I would, knowing Ernie Arneson a little bit. So, Ernie, listen, thank you so
much. You're welcome.
For giving us this time today. And you take care, lady.
Bye-bye.
Take care. We'll see you. Bye-bye.